hillsides, the open sky, the dark place in the trees where a wolverine gnawed on the leg of some small dead animal. This was the child's home.
"Can we stop here just for a moment?" Mabel asked.
It had been a long time since she had felt the urge to draw so strongly. They sat on a rise looking over the valley. She took her sketchbook and pencil from her pack and ignored her numb, cold fingers as she began to draw. Faina held the marten before her so she could again study its whiskered snout and angled eyes. Then she quickly drew the fur and claw of its brown padded feet. She flipped the page and did a rough sketch of the snow-heavy spruce branches above them, and then the mountains looming up from the river. As the light dwindled, she tried to recall the bird wing nailed to the tree and the ermine tracks across the snow. She tried to remember it all and to think of it as home. Maybe here on the page, she could reduce it to line and curve and at last understand it. She could see, now that she had been shown. The sun had disappeared behind them, and the girl pointed across the valley to the mountain slopes aglow in a cool purple pink. Silhouetted against the sky, tendrils of snow unfurled from the peaks, whipped by what must have been a brutal wind. Here on the rise, though, the air was still. The colors were distant, impossible, untouchable.
"That's what my name means," Faina said, still pointing.
"Mountain?"
"No, that light. Papa named me for the color on the snow when the sun turns."
"Alpenglow," Mabel whispered. She felt the awe of walking into a cathedral, the sense that she was being shown something powerful and intimate, and in its presence must speak softly, if at all. She stared into that color, trying to imagine a father who could name his child for such beauty and then abandon her.
"We should go," Faina said. "It will be night soon."
The child led Mabel back to the homestead, to the warm cabin where Jack waited with hot tea and bread he had baked in a Dutch oven.
"So," he said, "what did you see?"
Chapter 33. "Dear Mabel, your letters and sketches have become quite an attraction at our home. Whenever one arrives, we host a dinner party and invite many of our closest friends and relatives. With your permission, I have read the letters aloud, and your sketches have been passed from one hand to the next, along with exclamations of, 'Remarkable! Such beauty!' More than once, I've been told that you are the frontier equivalent of an Italian master studying human anatomy. Your sketches of the sable's snarling teeth and clawed feet were among the favorites this last night, as were your studies of the alder cones and winter-killed grasses. Your letters, too, catch glimpses of this wild place that has become your home. You always did have a talent for expressing yourself, and perhaps no other time in your life have you had such wondrous sights to express. Our only wish is that you would write more often. I do believe I will hold on to everything you send, and someday you should publish a book of your drawings and observations. There is something fanciful and yet feral about them. Along with your interest in the tale of the Snow Maiden, I am reminded of the time you spent as a child chasing fairies in the woods near our home. As I recall, you slept more than one night in those great oak trees, and when Mother found you the next morning, you would swear you had seen fairies that flew like butterflies and lit up the night like lightning bugs. I remember with some shame that the rest of us teased you about seeing such spirits, but now my own grandchildren chase similar fancies, and I do not discourage them. In my old age, I see that life itself is often more fantastic and terrible than the stories we believed as children, and that perhaps there is no harm in finding magic among the trees. Your loving sister, Ada." Chapter 34. Esther burst into the cabin like a friendly hen, flapping and chattering and nearly knocking Mabel over as she tried to open the door for her. In one hand, she held a towel-covered cast-iron pot, and with the other she hugged Mabel and kissed her on the cheek.
"So, is this what it takes to have dinner with you two?" she said, and pushed past Mabel to set the pot on the wood stove. "George has got the dessert, that is, if he doesn't eat it on the way in here. Should be enough chicken and dumplings for all of us. Links and dumplings, I should say, but it just doesn't have the same ring to it. Guess we could call it kitten and dumplings."
Esther laughed and flung her coat across the back of a chair.
"Links? You cooked a lynx? Oh, don't make that face. Have you ever had it? Absolutely, positively, the best meat you'll ever taste. Garrett had it live in a snare, so he killed it clean and brought home the meat. Guess we raised him right after all."
"Has he come too?"
"Nope. That's the only reason we might have enough food. That boy could eat a side of beef and then ask for seconds. But he's out these next few nights, sigh-washing it on his long trap line."
"Sigh-washing?"
"Like an Indian. No tent, no creature comforts. He packs light and travels hard."
"Oh.
You got a spoon I can stir this with?"
Before she could help, Esther had found one, and Mabel watched with fond amusement as Esther once again took over her home. Within minutes, she had tied one of Mabel's aprons around her waist, taste-tested the links, set the table, and added another log to the fire, though Mabel had just stocked it.
"I want to hear all about what you've been up to, but first, you've got to take a nip of this."
Esther pulled a small glass bottle from the back pocket of her men's work pants and set it on the table.
"Cranberry cordial. Positively heavenly. Quick, get us some glasses so we can finish it off before the men come."
Mabel didn't move from her seat, as Esther was already on her way to the cupboard. She came back with two of Mabel's jelly jars and filled each half full with a deep red liquid. It was sweet and tart and thick on Mabel's tongue, and it warmed her throat.
"It's delicious."
"Told you.
Here, have a bit more. This is my last bottle, and I'll be damned if I'll let George have any of it. He polished off the last of my blueberry cordial without even asking."
Mabel drank it in a gulp, then took another after Esther emptied the bottle into their glasses.
"There, now, that'll do."
Just then, George and Jack came in, kicking snow off their boots.
"Well, where's the cake? You didn't leave it in the wagon, did you?"
George smiled sheepishly, one hand behind his back.
"Sorry, dear. Couldn't help myself." He smacked his lips. "It was mighty good, though. You better be joking, or I'll..."
George grinned and pulled the cake out from behind his back.
"Not one piece missing. Jack'll vouch for me."
Jack gave a nod with exaggerated gravity. Then he looked at Mabel.
"Are you feeling well?"
"What makes you ask?"
"Your cheeks are flushed."
Mabel saw Esther out of the corner of her eye, tipping a thumb up to her lips as if her hand were a bottle.
"Tried to slow her down, but you know how she can be."
"Esther!" Mabel protested.
"Oh, I'm just teasing. That cordial does have a kick, though, doesn't it?"
"A kick? You mean it has alcohol in it?"
"Does it have alcohol in it? Are you pulling my leg? Don't know what the point be otherwise."
"Oh, Jack, I had no idea. I thought it was just a sweet dessert drink, but it did seem hot in my throat."
Jack grinned and kissed Mabel on the cheek. "You got any more of that, Esther?"
"Nope. Your wife polished it off."
The room was warm and soft-edged as Mabel tried to keep up with the flow of conversation and the passing of food around the table. For a moment, she seemed to slip out of her body, and it was a pleasant sensation to see four friends sharing food, laughing and talking in the small cabin in the wilderness.
"Well, cat ain't so bad, eh?"
"No, George." Jack leaned back in his chair and patted his belly. "I've got to say, I had my doubts, but that was tasty."
"Thanks, Esther. And give our thanks to Garrett, too."
After they cleared the table, Esther insisting the men help as well,
Jack and George went to the barn to look at the plow they had been trying to patch together for another season. As the men left the cabin, the fresh night air rushed against Mabel's face, and she stood in the open door and breathed deeply. Behind her, she heard Esther fussing with the dishes. "Oh, please, don't wash those. I'll take care of them tomorrow."
"Splendid idea."
Esther sat down heavily at the table and propped her feet on the chair across from her.
"Wish we had a spot more cordial."
Mabel laughed. "I think I've had enough, thank you very much. But I'll get us some tea."
"Good. And then sit down. We've got some catching up to do. I'm a little worried about you."
"Worried? What makes you say such a thing?"
"I'm hearing things again. About you and that little girl. Now, don't think I don't see your lips sealing up tight. You think you're not going to say a word, but we've got to talk this out. Why is all this coming up again?"
The cabin became so quiet, Mabel could hear the fire crackling and the clock ticking. She didn't speak or move for some time while Esther waited patiently. Then Mabel went to the shelf and handed the book to Esther.
"What's this?"
"A children's book. It's one my father used to read to me. Not read, actually. See, it's in Russian." She opened the pages to one of the first color plates.
"And?"
"It's the story of an old couple who desperately want a child, and they make one out of snow. And she comes to life. The snow child does."
"I don't think I'm following you here."
"My sister always said I was a scatterbrain, my mind too full of fancies. A wild imagination, she called it."
"And?"
So, Mabel told her everything. About the winter they had shaped a child out of snow, and how Faina had come wearing the red mittens and scarf, and looking so much like the little girl they had made. She described how Jack had buried the father in the mountains, and learned he had died, leaving Faina an orphan, just hours before they built the snow figure. It was that night the child had come to them for the first time. "We've tried to convince her to stay with us, but she refuses. She says the wilderness is her home, and I've gone with her there, and it's true. It is her home. She walks on top of the snow, and I know it seems unbelievable, Esther, but she can hold a snowflake in the palm of her hand without it melting. Don't you see? She was reborn that night, reborn out of snow and suffering and love."
"Not to be quarrelsome, but nobody else has seen any sign of her. Me and Garrett, here working the farm with you those months, nary a glimpse of the child."
"She left. She was gone the entire summer, just as I told you."
"And now?"
"She came back, with the snow." Esther silently flipped through the pages of the book and looked at each illustration. "You think I'm crazy, don't you? It's like you said, the winters in the small cabin. A fever, didn't you call it? Cabin fever?" Esther let out a long sigh, then turned back to the first illustration of the old couple and the child, half snow and half human.
"Is that what you think?" Esther asked.
"No," Mabel said. "As fantastic as it all sounds, I know the child is real and that she has become a daughter to us. But I can't offer a single bit of evidence. You have no reason to believe me. I know that." Esther closed the book and, with her hands folded on top of it, looked directly at Mabel.
"I got to tell you, I had you wrong."
"What do you mean?" Mabel asked.
"There at the beginning, I took you for soft, a woman whose thoughts could be twisted around by a lonely winter. Someone better suited to a different place, a different kind of life."
Mabel's temper started to rise in her chest.
"Don't go getting all riled up," Esther went on. "Hear me out, because I've thought this through. I was wrong. I've gotten to know you pretty well, I'd say. Count you one of my dearest friends, and you're no weakling. A bit standoffish at first. Too tender-hearted, I suspect. And God knows you think too much. But you're no feeble-minded simpleton.
If you say this child of yours is real, then by God she must be real.
Thank you, Esther. But I know you're humoring me. As a friend, I'm pleased to hear, but humoring all the same.
Have you ever known me to change my mind just to humor someone? Esther said.
Mabel gave a small smile, slowly turning the teacup around in her hands.
Why aren't you jumping up and down? This might be a first. I'm owning up that I just might be wrong about something, but don't tell George. The shock would probably kill him, did.
It's almost spring, you know, Mabel said. Have you seen how the snow is melting? The river will soon break up.
Yep, seen that. What's that to do with...
Soon she will leave again. It's just like in the fairy tale. Faina will leave us in the spring, and I just can't bear the thought of it. What if we lose her? What if she never comes back to us? Esther sipped her tea thoughtfully. Then she set her cup down and looked at Mabel, as if carefully measuring her words.
Dear sweet Mabel, she said, we never know what is going to happen, do we? Life is always throwing us this way and that. That's where the adventure is, not knowing where you'll end up or how you'll fare. It's all a mystery, and when we say any different, we're just lying to ourselves. Tell me, when have you felt most alive?
Chapter 35. The March days began to lengthen. Jack watched the sun climb higher above the mountains each day. The snow was heavy and wet and melted from the eaves. Water ran along the surface of the river ice. And then one night, the skies cleared and cold fell like a fog over the valley. Jack awoke to find the fire burned to black coals and the windows frosted inside and out. After kindling the fire and pulling another quilt over Mabel as she slept, he set off for town. It was the coldest it had been all winter, and by the time he arrived at the general store, he wondered if his nose was frostbitten. He stood just inside the door and rubbed it gingerly.
"Don't worry," George teased from where he stood at the pot-bellied stove. "Mabel probably won't leave you when it falls off."
Jack joined him at the stove and rubbed his hands at the heat, trying to work some sensation back into them. "I've been meaning to tell you, Mabel still wears that hat most every day. It was a generous gift your son gave her.
You know, that's the only silver fox he's ever caught."
The boy could barely contain himself. Weeks on end, he kept asking me if Betty was done with it yet.
"Well, she puts it on even if she's just dashing out to the outhouse, especially with this weather."
George laughed and slapped his own backside as if his pants had gotten too hot.
"Esther'll get a kick out of that. Mabel in the outhouse with a fine fox fur hat. Now, don't you say a word or you'll get me in trouble for sure."
George laughed again.
"That boy of mine is going gangbusters this winter, running traps up and down the river, gone days at a time. Boyd's old Martin line, and now he's going after the wolves Esther saw at our place."
"Wolves?"
"A pack brought down a cow moose by the river. Not much shakes up my wife, but that did. She watched the whole bloody mess. The cow struggled hard with the snow so deep, and the wolves nipped at her and ripped out her guts even while she was trying to run. Me and Garrett walked down to the kill site a few days later, and there was nothing left but bones. You could see their teeth marks along the rib cage. Plucked clean, not even a speck of gristle left. Never seen anything like it. We've heard them howl a few times over our way. That sound stays with you."
"That it does. That it does." Jack decided he wouldn't mention the wolves to Mabel. He had made that mistake once before, after George told him about a lynx. One of the Bensons' neighbors had a small flock of domestic ducks. One night the farmer was marching his flock into the shed when a lynx ran in and snatched a duck right out from under his nose. The wildcat returned again and again over the next several weeks, slowly picking off birds and destroying the farmer's investment. The lynx would come in at night, kill a few, feed off them for several days, then return to take more. One morning, as the man opened the duck shed, the lynx dashed out at him, nearly gave the farmer a heart attack. Both George and Jack got a few chuckles out of the thought of the poor farmer stumbling backward as the overgrown house cat charged past him. Mabel, however, had not been amused. She refused to go to the outhouse after sunset, said she was afraid some wild animal would be lurking there. Jack tried to reassure her, but found himself standing guard by the outhouse door more than one night. Jack was preparing to leave the general store with a crate of supplies when he caught sight of the ice skates, their blades gleaming in the sunlit front window. He had not thought of them since he was a boy, skating on the cow pond. It was a crazy whim, but he went home with three pairs. The next evening, Faina came, and they settled into their familiar habits of preparing dinner and gathering at the table. When Faina yawned, Jack stood and announced, "Get your coats. We're going out." "What? Going out where?" Mabel asked.
"Down to the river."
The child jumped to her feet, her eyes alive. "Will we all go?" she asked.
Jack nodded.
"But it's freezing out there," Mabel said. "And why on earth will we go to the river?"
"No time for questions. Get dressed."
He rarely gave orders so bluntly, and Mabel seemed surprised into submission. They got their coats and boots, and Jack insisted Mabel put on long underwear and wool pants. He wrapped a scarf around her neck.
"There now. Mabel, you take the lantern."
He grabbed a canvas bag from beside the door. "What's that you're bringing?" Mabel asked. He merely raised an eyebrow comically and grinned. "And why are we going out in the middle of the night?" Again, just a flick of the brow. "I don't think I trust you. Not one little bit." It was cold outside, clear and still, with a nearly full moon shining just above the mountains. With the fresh snow and moonlight, they didn't need the lantern, but it gave a comforting glow. They followed the trail down to the Wolverine River.
"This way,"
Jack said, and he led them through a stand of willows and out toward a small side channel of the river. The wind had blown the ice clean of snow, and it glistened black beneath the moon. Jack found a driftwood log and had Faina and Mabel sit side by side. He knelt by their feet. "For heaven's sake, Jack, what are you doing?" Jack pulled the skates out of the bag. Mabel started to stand.
"Oh, no, you don't," she said. "Have you lost your mind? You are not getting those on my feet. I'll fall flat on my back, or I'll break through the ice and drown."
Jack laughed, grabbed her feet, and buckled the blades onto her boots. Mabel sputtered indignantly. "Quick, Faina," Jack said. "Do you know what these are?" The girl shook her head, her lips pinched tight in fear and excitement.
"They're ice skates. You put them on your feet and slide on the ice."
He showed her how to put them on and buckle the straps. Then he returned to Mabel and put his mouth to her ear.
"I'd never let anything happen to you. You know that, don't you?"
Mabel's eyes glittered in the moonlight. "Yes, I do know." And she wobbled as she stood up.
"The river's still frozen thick," he said. "All this last thaw did was smooth the ice to a perfect shine. And even if we did fall through, this isn't the main channel. The water's only a foot deep. We just get cold and wet, but even that won't happen. I promise."
Jack put on his own skates and led them onto the ice. Mabel was hesitant, but soon her childhood came flying back to her, and she slid confidently across the ice. The child, on the other hand, seemed to have left her braver self, the one who slew wild animals and slept alone in the wilderness, back on solid ground, and she surprised Jack by clinging to his arm like a toddler.
"It's all right," he told her. "Even if you fall, it only smacks your bottom a bit. No harm done."
As if on cue, Mabel slipped and fell.
"Dash it all," she said.
Before Jack could shake free of Faina and rush to her side, Mabel had eased onto her knees and stood again.
"I should have strapped a pillow to my backside,"
she laughed and dusted herself off. Jack skated faster while Faina merely held on and let herself be pulled.
Mabel joined them, and the three held hands and slowly skated in a circle. The riverbed echoed with the sound of their whoops and laughter and their blades carving into the ice. Mabel let go and skated farther up the channel.
"How far is it safe?" she called back.
"All the way to that corner,"
and he watched as Mabel gained speed.
"Will she be all right?" Faina whispered, still holding onto his arm.
"Yes. Yes, she will."
Eventually, Faina grew comfortable on the skates, and Jack set the lantern in the center of the ice. Mabel returned to skate slowly but gracefully around and around the light, while Faina followed like a long-legged fawn, learning to walk. Jack skated in the opposite direction and caught Mabel by a hand.
"We used to skate like this together when we were young," he said as they passed Faina. "Do you remember?"
"How could I forget? You were always trying to kiss me, but I could outskate you, so you never got the chance."
She laughed, pulled her hand free, and skated upriver. Jack pursued her across the ice, the night-blackened trees and sky flying past him.
"Faster! Go faster!" Faina called out,
and Jack didn't know who she was cheering on, but he skated as fast as he dared and prayed his blades wouldn't catch in a crack or a rough spot. Mabel stayed just out of reach until she slowed and swung around to face him. Hand in hand, they skated back to where Faina stood in her small circle of lantern light. Without a word, Jack and Mabel each took one of the child's hands and skated up the river, following the curves of the bank. Faina squealed in delight. Even through the cushion of their thick coats, Jack could feel her small arm folded in his, and it was as if his very heart were cradled in those joined elbows. The ice was like wet glass, and they glided fast enough to create a breeze against their faces. He looked at Mabel and saw tears running down her cheeks, and wondered if it was the cold that made her eyes water. As they neared the corner, where the small channel rejoined the main river, they slowed to a stop, and the three of them stood arm in arm, Jack and Mabel gasping for breath. The moon lit up the entire valley, gleaming off the river ice and glowing on the white mountains.
"Let's keep going," Faina whispered,
and Jack, too, wanted to skate on, up the Wolverine River, around the bend, through the gorge, and into the mountains, where spring never comes and the snow never melts. Part 3. From Snieguruchka, translated by Lucy Maxim. As she gazed upon him, love filled every fiber of her being, and she knew that this was the emotion that she had been warned against by the spirit of the wood. Great tears welled up in her eyes, and suddenly she began to melt. Chapter 36. He wasn't always there. Some days Mabel crept through the snow and down to the creek behind the cabin, and the creature wouldn't show himself. There'd be only the trickle of water through snow and ice. But if she sat, patient and silent, at the base of the spruce tree, eventually he might appear. His small brown head would peek up from a pool of open water in the creek, or his tail would disappear over a snowy hummock. This November day, the river otter did not keep her waiting. She heard ice splinter, a splash, and then he was just the other side of the small creek. She expected him to dash across a log or run humpbacked down the bank as he always did. Instead, he paused at the water's edge, turned toward her, and stood up on his hind legs. He was remarkably still, supported by his thick tail, his front paws dangling at his chest. For longer than Mabel could hold her breath, the otter stared at her with his eyes like deep eddies, and then he dropped to all fours and scampered down the creek. "Farewell, old man, until we meet again." She had no way to know its age or gender, but there was something in the light-colored chin and long, coarse whiskers that reminded her of an old man's beard. From a distance, the otter gave a comical, mischievous impression,
but when it slithered close, Mabel could smell fish blood and a wet chill. She told no one of the otter. Garrett would want to trap it. Faina would ask her to draw it. She refused to confine it by any means because, in some strange way, she knew it was her heart, living, twisting muscle beneath bristly, damp fur, breaking through thin ice, splashing in cold creek water, sliding belly down across snow, joyful, though it should have known better. It wasn't just the river otter. She once spied a gray-brown coyote slinking across a field with his mouth half open as if in laughter. She watched bohemian waxwings like twilight shadows flock from tree to tree as if some greater force orchestrated their flight. She saw a white ermine sprint past the barn with a fat vole in its mouth, and each time Mabel felt something leap in her chest, something hard and pure. She was in love. 8 years she'd lived here, and at last the land had taken hold of her, and she could comprehend some small part of Faina's wildness. The seasons of the past 6 years had been like an ocean tide, giving and taking, pulling the girl away, and then bringing her back. Each spring, Faina left for the alpine high country, where the caribou migrated and the mountains cupped eternal snow, and Mabel no longer wept, though she knew she would miss her. Homesteaders called that bittersweet season when the river ice gives way and the fields turn to mud, breakup. But Mabel found something tender and gentle in it. She said goodbye to the girl, just as the bog violets bloomed purple and white along the creeks and cow moose nuzzled their newborns, just as the sun began to push winter out of the valley. And then, when the days stretched long, the land softened and warmed, and the farm thrived. Beyond the barn, beneath a cottonwood tree, there was the picnic table Jack and Garrett had built, and often on top of it during the summer there would be a moonshine jar filled with wildflowers. Most Sundays, they shared a meal with the Bensons, sometimes here, sometimes at their homestead. When the weather was fine and the bugs miraculously scarce, they ate outdoors. Jack and George would build an alder fire in a pit early in the morning and then roast a hunk of meat from a black bear Garrett had shot in the spring. Esther would bring potato and beet salad. Mabel would bake a fresh rhubarb pie and spread a white tablecloth. Then the two women would walk together arm in arm and pick fireweed and bluebells. In the background, they would hear the men talking and laughing as the flames in the pit sputtered and flared with the bear fat drippings. When Mabel went into the cabin to get plates and silverware, Jack would sometimes come up behind her, softly pull back the wisps of her hair, and kiss her neck. "You've never been more beautiful," he would say. Harvest would come, and sometimes during those long, exhausting days, it would be as Mabel once imagined. She and Jack together in the field as they gathered potatoes into burlap sacks or cut cabbages from their stalks. And even as she wiped sweat from her face and tasted grit between her teeth, she tried to breathe in the sweetness of the moment. At night, they would rub each other's sore muscles and jokingly complain of their aches. Mabel always more than Jack, though she knew his pain was so much worse. Then, when the days shortened and the first frost came, they whispered their blessings and prayed for snow. Mabel would try to guess how much Faina had grown since they had last seen her, and she would sew wool stockings and long underwear, and sometimes a new coat, always blue wool with white fur trim, and snowflakes embroidered down the front. Each time the girl arrived, she was taller and more beautiful than they had remembered, and she would bring gifts from the mountains. One year it was a sack of dried fish, another it was a caribou hide, tanned, supple, and scented with wild herbs. She would hug them and kiss them and say she had missed them, and then she would run off into the snowy trees she called home. Mabel no longer shouted Faina's name into the wilderness or tried to think of ways to make her stay. Instead, she sat at the table and by candlelight sketched her face, impish chin, clever eyes. Then she tucked these sketches into the leather-covered children's book that told the story of the Snow Maiden. Winter after winter, Faina returned to their cabin in the woods, and in all that time, no one else ever saw her. It suited Mabel fine. Just as with the otter, she came to guard the girl as a secret. Chapter 37 Garrett watched the fox through his iron sights. It was still a few hundred yards away, but its gait did not falter as it traveled up the river toward him. It wouldn't be long before it closed the distance. Garrett leaned back into the cottonwood log, wedged his elbow against his knee, steadied his rifle. His finger rested lightly at the trigger. He knew it could be the one. For years, Jack forbade him from killing the red fox that hunted the fields and riverbed near their farm. He said it belonged to a girl who lived alone in the forest, hunted in the mountains, survived winters that killed grown men. A girl no one ever saw. Garrett's rifle gently rose and fell with his breaths, but his eyes remained fixed on the animal. He couldn't be sure. In the fading November light, it could almost be a cross fox, a mix of silver, black, and red. It stopped and raised its nose to the air as if it had scented something, then resumed its path up the snowy river. The sun sank a degree, and the last golden rays disappeared down the valley. He let the fox come. When it was less than 150 yards away, Garrett sat forward, put his cheek to the rifle stock, shut his left eye, and lined the iron sights on the fox's spine. But the fox veered, abruptly turned its tail toward Garrett, and passed behind a willow shrub headed for the nearby poplars. It moved quickly. Garrett lowered the rifle. He'd hesitated a moment too long. It would soon be too dark to shoot, and the fox would be lost to the trees. Then he saw that the animal had stopped and sat watching him from the forest's edge. Garrett leaned again into his rifle, squinted down the barrel, and pulled the trigger. It took only the one shot. The impact was enough to flip the small animal onto its side, and it did not move again. Garrett ejected the shell, then got up from his position against the log. With his rifle at his side, he walked until he stood over the dead fox. The animal had thinned to a scruffy frame, and the fur along its muzzle and hackles had whitened with age so that perhaps, in poor light and at a distance, it could be mistaken for a cross. But there was no doubt. It was the one. All these years, Garrett had obeyed Jack's command. The fox would dart across a field or cross his path in the forest, and Garrett would let it pass. Each time was an irritation. Nothing indicated that this fox was anything more than a ranging wild animal. But now that he had killed it, he regretted it. He was honor-bound. He should take it to Jack and Mabel's door. He should confess, apologize. Jack's reproach would be stern. Mabel would be silent. She would smooth her apron with her hands, gently shake her head. He had to get rid of it. He could skin it out and try to sell the pelt, but it was shabby and practically worthless. His mom would ask where he got it. His dad would want to see the fur. Garrett would end up telling lies, and lies had a way of getting complicated. He shouldered his rifle, picked up the fox, and carried it into the trees. He was surprised at how thin and bony it felt in his arms, like an old barn cat. Beyond the poplars, in a dense stand of spruce, Garrett arranged the animal in the snow at the base of a tree. He broke off evergreen boughs and laid them over it. He hoped it would snow again soon. As he turned to walk home in the dusk, he no longer felt like a 19-year-old man, but instead a shameful little boy.
"Garrett, glad you could come over." Jack greeted him at the cabin door and shook his hand. "We were hoping you'd make it this evening."
At the kitchen table, Mabel smiled up at him.
"Mom said you all wanted me to come over."
"Yes, it's about time," Mabel said.
"What's it about?"
Garrett's stomach turned.
"Have a seat," Jack said. He held out a chair.
"All right."
Garrett sat and looked from Jack to Mabel, and back to Jack again. "So, this is how it is," Jack began. "We've been wanting to talk to you about the farm."
"But maybe we should eat dinner first," Mabel asked.
"Nope, business first. This is something we've been meaning to do for a long time." He looked at Garrett. "You know, we couldn't have made a go of this place without you."
"I don't know about that. Just been a hired hand. Could have been another one."
"That's where you're wrong. These past years, we haven't been able to pay you near what you're worth."
"And you were never just a hired hand. You've been so much more to both of us," Mabel said. "What would I have done without you to discuss Mark Twain and Charles Dickens with?"
Garrett's shoulders relaxed some, and he let out a slow breath. "You know what this is?" Jack gestured toward some papers spread on the table in front of them.
"No, can't say that I do."
"These are legal papers that make you a partner in this farm. And they also lay out that when we are both gone, this place will become yours. Now hear us out before you start shaking your head. You know we don't have a son of our own to leave this place to, and the truth is, you made it what it is today."
"I don't know. Now, we understand farming hasn't always been your aim," Jack went on, "but it seems to us that you take pride in what you've helped us do here. And maybe you'd be able to run this place along with your trapping and such in the winters."
"Or," Mabel added, "you would be free to sell the place after we're gone."
"I wouldn't. I don't know." "Well, think it over, if you'd like," Jack said. "We aren't rushing off to the grave yet, are we, love?"
"No. I hope not anytime soon. But, Garrett, whatever you decide, we want you to understand how much you've meant to us. We are proud of the man you've become."
"Mabel, you're embarrassing the boy."
"Please let me finish. It is true what Jack said. We wouldn't be here. This farm wouldn't be here if it weren't for you and all your hard work. We don't have much in this world, but we want to offer you what little we do have."
"Are you sure?
I mean, isn't there anybody else, somebody from your family?" Garrett slid the papers back toward Jack.
"Nope. You're the closest we've got," Jack said.
"I was never expecting anything like this." "We know, but it's the right thing to do."
"I should talk it over with my folks," Garrett said.
"But I guess it's mostly up to you two."
"We've never been more sure," Jack said,
and he reached across the table and shook his hand again.
Chapter 38. It was only the middle of November, but the snow lay heavy and deep across the land. Garrett went on foot to search for tracks: wolf, marten, mink, coyote, fox. But it was Wolverine he had his heart set on. He was a trapper of experience, and yet every winter this one animal eluded him. He couldn't have put it to words, but he hungered after its bold will, its ferocious and solitary manner. To enter the Wolverine's territory, he would have to travel farther into the mountains than he ever had before. He hiked up from the riverbed into the foothills, and as the land steepened, he wished he had worn snowshoes. He carried a light pack with enough supplies to get him through the night, if necessary, but in this weather he would be wet and cold. As the morning wore on, it began to snow again, and he considered turning back, but always the next ridge, the draw beyond, lured him on. Maybe just ahead he would find a rocky, narrow valley and Wolverine tracks. When he crested a foothill dotted with spruce and saw spread before him a marsh, its hummocks of grass covered in snow, he turned to go back. There would be no Wolverine here, and the fresh snow was burying any tracks. He was stopped by a sound like a wood stove bellows, air forced hard. He spun around and saw something at the other end of the marsh. He crouched low behind a birch log and squinted against the falling snow. At first, it appeared to be a mound of snow like the others in the marsh, but larger and strangely formed. And then great white wings, broader than Garrett's own arm span, beat against the air. Again he heard the sound of bellows, and knew it came from those wings. He crawled on his hands and knees around the fallen birch, the snow up to his chest. He crept closer, hiding behind one hummock and then another. When he again focused on the white creature, he saw something else. Blonde hair, a human face. Snowflakes pelted his eyes, and he blinked hard, but the face remained among the beating wings and the awful hissing sound. His skin prickled along his neck, and sweat ran down his back. But still, he crept closer, so close that the next time the creature beat its wings, he thought the air moved against his face. A white swan, its long neck serpentine, turned its head to the side and looked at him with one of its gleaming black eyes. Then it lowered its head, hunched its wings, and hissed. Behind the wings, the face appeared again. A girl crouched in the snow just beyond the swan. She stood, and at first Garrett thought she had spotted him, but she was looking only at the swan. Her blue coat was embroidered with snowflakes, and on her head she wore a marten fur hat. It was her, the one they had whispered about all these years, the child no one but Jack and Mabel had ever seen, the girl who made a pet of a wild fox. Winter after winter, not even a passing glimpse, not a single footprint in the snow, and now here she was before him. And she wasn't the little girl he had always pictured. She was tall and slender, only a few years younger than he. The swan's head nearly reached the girl's shoulders, and its wings enveloped her as it flapped them in warning and hopped toward her. Garrett saw then that one of its feet was bound in a snare loop. It was not the thin-boned hare or downy ptarmigan she had probably intended to catch. The swan was a beautiful giant, muscle and sinew pounding beneath white feather, black eyes set deep and fierce to the black beak. He wondered if the girl would set it free. Perhaps she could slip behind it and snap the snare, but he doubted she could get close enough without the swan attacking her. Then he wondered, would she kill it? The possibility sickened him, and he didn't know why. Because the girl was willowy, with delicate features and small hands? Because the swan had wings like an angel and flew through fairy tales with a maiden upon its back? Garrett knew the truth. The swan meat could feed the girl for weeks. She began to unbutton her coat. Spellbound, Garrett watched, even as he felt he should look away. She set the coat on a bush behind her, then her hat as well. She wore a flowered cotton dress with what looked like long underwear beneath it. She bent and removed a knife from a sheath on her leg. The swan strained at the willow bush that anchored the snare. The girl held the knife and crept slowly around a hummock to the other side of the swan, trying to position herself behind it. But it followed her, turned its head, and hopped around to face her. She would never be able to take it head on. The bird's beak would cut through her skin, break her small bones. It hissed again and swept its wings at her, not to fly, but to attack. Garrett lowered himself to the ground, not wanting to be seen. As the girl stepped toward the swan, the beating of its wings became more powerful, swirling the snow and air, and its hisses turned into a terrible cracking growl. She circled quickly around its back and jumped onto the swan. Its free leg gave way, and it crumpled, but its massive wings still beat beneath her. The girl held tightly, her face turned to the side, and grabbed the swan's sinewy neck. She slid one hand up until it clenched just below the bird's head, and she held it at arm's length. It seemed fatigued from the struggle, and for a moment both were still. Garrett could hear the girl breathing. And then the swan's neck writhed in her hand, and it lunged toward her face. The beak glanced across her cheek. She shoved the swan's head down into the wet snow and spread herself on top of the bird. Garrett could imagine the heat of the swan's body beneath her, could hear the bird hissing and sputtering, and that growl from somewhere in its strange round body. The swan fought, then calmed, and the girl reached with her knife toward its head, slid it under the neck, and cut sharply upward. She wiped her face with the back of her bloody hand, and then, beneath her, the swan's wings flapped weakly, spasmed, were still again. The girl collapsed beside the bird, its dead wings stretching broad. The blood spread brightly beneath them,
and the snow fell. She didn't move for some time. Garrett's legs were stiff from the cold, and he felt the need to stand, but mesmerized, could not. For the next hour, he watched as she gutted the swan and cut off the head and black-webbed feet. Steam rose from the body cavity and strewn entrails. She set aside the liver, the plum-sized heart, the sinewy neck. She steadily skinned the swan until she had a sagging pelt of white wings, white feathers, and bloody skin. Garrett expected her to throw it aside, but instead she laid it out in the snow and carefully rolled it up, the wings folded within the skin. She put the pelt inside a sack. Then she dragged the clean carcass away from the kill site, where the scraps and blood would attract ravens, magpies, and other scavengers. Garrett watched her climb a small spruce at the edge of the clearing and began to tie the carcass and sack to a limb. She was facing away from him, so as quickly as he could, Garrett crawled back the way he had come. When he reached the spruce trees, he hid behind one and watched her kneel in the marsh and scrub her hands and the knife blade in the snow. Then she put on her coat and hat. Garrett turned down the hill and ran. The snow had stopped, and it was beginning to clear. Twilight hinted at winter to come. Twisting swaths of fog rose up from the river, and as he ran down the mountainside, it was as if he were descending into clouds. Overhead, he heard a V of migrating snow geese cry their goodbyes into the purpling sky, and for the first time in his life, the sound frightened him. Chapter 39. Mabel and Faina were cutting out paper snowflakes to decorate the little spruce tree in the corner of the cabin when the Bensons showed up unannounced with Christmas gifts. Esther shoved the door open without knocking, and Faina bolted to the opposite side of the room, her eyes wide with fear, her muscles taut as if ready to spring. For a moment, Mabel feared the girl would try to break out the glass window. She went to her and gently took hold of her wrist, hoping to calm her with her touch. Esther stood stock still, her mouth gaping. Mabel would have found it amusing had it not been for Faina's terror. Mabel straightened, still holding on to the girl's arm, and took a slow breath. "Esther," she said, "I would like you to meet Faina." "Faina? This is my dear friend, Esther." Just then, George and Garrett bumped noisily through the door behind her, and Esther waved a hand and shushed them as if they were about to startle a woodland creature. "It's the girl, George," she whispered, without taking her eyes off Faina. "She's here. She's right here in front of me." George laughed out loud, but behind him, Garrett was silent. The boy's eyes were dark and wide until he caught Mabel looking at him, and then he stepped back behind his father. Mabel nudged the girl. "Hello," Faina said quietly. "My God," Esther said, "she is real. Your girl is flesh and blood." The next few hours were awkward. Esther tried to include Faina in the barrage of gifts and treats, as if she'd known all along she would be there. "Oh, here. This one is for you," Esther said, handing her a wrapped package. Faina was silent, and at first did not even put out her hands to accept it. Mabel and Jack both moved to intercede, but stopped themselves. The girl took the package, and with a somber expression, held it in her lap. "Well, go on. Aren't you going to open it?" Esther said. Faina looked so frightened and confused, her cheeks flushed an unhealthy crimson, that Mabel longed to open the door to let her escape into the cold. "Do you need help, Faina?" The cabin was stiflingly hot. No one spoke. All eyes were on the girl. Finally, Faina began to pull away the paper. When at last she held up a flower-embroidered handkerchief and smiled as if in polite recognition, Mabel thought she would faint with relief. "Thank you," Faina said, and Esther's eyes glistened. As the two families gathered for dinner, the tension eased. Faina remained quiet, but she was well-mannered, carefully passing dishes when prompted and giving a small smile here and there. Garrett, however, seemed incapable of speaking or looking at anyone
particularly the girl. Her very presence seemed an affront to him, and Mabel did not know what to make of it.
"You know, the boy is catching a pile of lynx this year," George said around a mouthful of fruitcake. "The hare population is up, so there are a ton of cats all over the valley."
"Is that so?" Jack asked.
Mabel looked at Garrett, and his face called to mind that first summer he came to work on the farm, irritable, petulant.
"Well, the man asked you a question."
George swung his arm across the back of Garrett's chair. Garrett looked back down at his plate and mumbled incoherently.
"Hmm," Jack said agreeably, though Mabel knew he had not heard Garrett's response either. "What's the matter with you, boy? Speak up. You got nothing to be ashamed of. You've been doing some good trapping this year."
"Yeah, I guess I've gotten a few." And then his head was down again, and he poked at his dessert without ever taking a bite.
Was this the honorary son, the one who now cast sullen looks in everyone's direction? Wasn't it at this very table that Garrett had shaken Jack's hand and said it would be a privilege to be farming partners, to inherit the homestead when that time came? For the rest of the evening, the boy did not utter a word. George and Esther went on with their stories. Mabel cleaned up dinner and paced behind Faina. The girl was shrinking in her chair, beads of sweat gathering on the bridge of her nose. Mabel fanned her with a napkin and wiped at her temples. "Too warm, much too warm," Mabel whispered to herself. At last, the Benson said it was time to leave, and Mabel was relieved to usher them all out the door. George, Esther, and Garrett to their horses and wagon, and Faina to the snowy forest. Chapter 40. Garrett cursed and urged his horse up the steep hill to follow the footprints. He ducked to avoid a spruce branch, but still managed to get covered in snow. When he reached the top of the ridge, he reined in the horse, shook the snow from his shoulders, and leaned from the saddle. The tracks were old, shapeless indentations beneath several inches of snow, but they were hers. The horse shifted, antsy to either go back or go on, so Garrett went on, following the tracks as they wove among the spruce trees. He was tired of the girl. For 6 years he had listened to Jack talk about her. Faina, 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 the angel from the woods, and yet for all the talk, never once had Garrett seen hide nor hair of the girl. Each winter, he watched for her tracks, half hoping he'd spot them, half hoping Jack and Mabel were crazy. Sometimes he would think he saw a flicker in the brush, but it would only be a bird. So how was it that this winter was different, that everywhere he went the forest snow was riddled with her tracks and he couldn't be free of her? Everything about the girl filled him with guilt. He had shot her fox and told no one. He had spied on her. Again and again his mind returned to the scene, to the girl's struggle with the swan. The emotions it sparked bothered him, but he could not leave it be. As he pursued her, he told himself he was only going where he wanted, toward the mountains, toward the wolverine. And it was true. Wolverine roamed higher in the alpine country, closer to the glacier. He would never catch one in the lowlands, where he trapped coyote, fox, beaver, and mink. He followed the tracks up into a narrow ravine where boulders were hidden by the snow. The horse stumbled occasionally, and finally Garrett dismounted and led the animal. Although getting on in years, the gelding was still steady and sure-footed, and knew the mountains like few other horses. Garrett's traps and chains clanked in the burlap sack strapped behind the saddle. Water ran down through the boulders beneath the snow. At any moment, he expected to see the stout, bear-like paw prints of a lone wolverine. Instead, he saw small tracks, this time fresher. The girl again. Probably today. Garrett paused, hands on his knees, to look at the trail. Bare traces on top of the snow, like a lynx or snowshoe hare. The girl was nearly as tall as Garrett. So how could she be so insubstantial as to not sink into the snow? Irritated fascination twisted in his gut. He stomped ahead, erasing the delicate tracks with his boots. She was near. He was certain. Something in the air had changed. It was the same when he stalked a moose.
Abruptly, the woods quieted, and his senses sharpened. When he looked ahead, he saw the girl, standing just out of the trees, her blue coat decorated in snowflakes, her hair an unearthly blonde. He could turn back, but surely she'd seen him too. She waited for him. He continued up the ravine, trying to walk slower than his heart raced. She did not move or speak until he was within several feet of her. She eyed the horse nervously, but when Garrett started to tell her not to be afraid, she spoke over him.
"You are the one who killed my fox."
For a moment, Garrett could not make his mouth work. How could she know?
"Yes," he finally choked. "Why did you come here?"
He could have asked her the same. He had no reason to feel inferior to her.
"Wolverine," he said. "I'm scouting for Wolverine."
"Here?"
"There's got to be one on this creek, I'm sure of it."
The girl turned her head side to side. Fury slowed Garrett's heart to a dull thud.
"What do you know?" he asked. "You know this whole valley?"
She gave a short nod.
"Why should I believe you?"
Garrett pushed forward, as if to go past her, and caught her scent. Labrador tea, elderberry, nettle, fresh snow. It was so faint that he found himself inhaling deeply, trying to catch more of it. The girl turned her back and bent to the ground. In the snow was a woven birch bark pack he hadn't noticed. She stood it up at her feet and began to pull something from it. When she faced him, she held a dead wolverine by its front paws. Its head was like that of a small bear, its body compact, legs short and powerful. It was a large animal, close to 40 pounds, Garrett guessed, and she should have struggled under its weight, but she easily tossed it at his feet. Behind him, the horse nickered and pulled back.
"What's this?" he asked.
"A wolverine."
"I can see that. What are you doing with it?"
"I'm giving it to you so you can leave." Garrett was speechless for a moment.
"I don't want it," he said crossly. "Not like this."
"I'll skin it for you," said the girl, and she turned again to her pack.
"What? Hell, that's not what I mean. Why should you give it to me?"
"I don't want it. You do."
"Why'd you kill it if you didn't want it?"
"It was stealing Martin and bait. Take it." Garrett had never been so mad in his life. To think of the years he had tried to find a wolverine to trap, and here was this girl throwing one at his feet like a discarded carcass and ordering him to leave. He turned back to his horse, grabbed the saddle horn, and mounted.
"Won't you take it with you?"
The girl's voice was higher pitched, more childlike than before. Garrett didn't answer. He shook the reins, and the horse began to work its way slowly down the ravine.
"There are no others here," the girl shouted after him. "Just this one."
He did not look back.
"Take it with you," she called, "so you don't have to come back." "I don't want your blasted wolverine," he yelled over his shoulder, "and I'll be back if I want to. You don't own this land."
He did not allow himself to look back until he was nearing the ridge. When he did, he saw the girl standing in the same place, the wolverine at her feet. He couldn't be sure, but he thought there was anger in the tight line of her lips. Once Garrett believed he was out of the girl's sight, he dismounted again. The ground was too treacherous to ride. Beneath the snow, creek water was frozen in pools, and ice coated the boulders. He led the horse to a bit of open water in the creek and let it drink. When the horse was done, he crouched and scooped some of the water in his hand and drank. It was sweet and cold, and left him queasy. He had no intention of going home yet. He still had most of the day ahead of him, and he had not set a single trap. He had always been respectful of other trappers' territories. A bachelor not much older than Garrett had claimed the land downstream from Jack and Mabel's, and he did not trespass there. He hadn't trapped Boyd's trails, even when he saw that the old man's pole sets went untouched, until Boyd bestowed the line upon him. A man could be shot for stealing a trapper's catch, and even edging in on his territory was considered disrespectful.
But this? This was just a girl snaring a few rabbits. Never mind the wolverine. That had been a fluke, surely. But he knew it was no such thing. Wolverine weren't caught on a fluke, and he had watched her kill the swan. She was capable. He wiped creek water across his brow and dried his hand on his coat before pulling his leather gloves back on. It was beginning to snow. He hadn't anticipated that. The sky had been cloudless this morning. When he had gone to the outhouse before sunrise, he had seen the northern lights twisting and turning through the blackness the way they do, only on clear, cold nights. But here it was, only a few hours later, snowing. He looked toward the mountains, but low-lying clouds had swallowed them. "Well, Jackson, time to head home after all, eh?" He didn't normally talk to a horse, but he was uneasy. The snow was falling steadily now, and a slight wind blew up from the riverbed. He pulled himself into the saddle and was momentarily disoriented. The air was so thick with snowflakes, he could see only the outlines of the nearest trees. "Down the hill, Jackson? Can't go wrong by heading toward the river." Soon, though, blowing snow blinded Garrett, and the horse stumbled along the disappearing trail. "Jesus," he said under his breath. "Where did this come from?" Never before had he seen a winter storm come up so quickly, whipped out of nothing. He turned up the collar of his coat and pulled a wool hat out of his saddlebag. He slid off the saddle, and the snow was above his knees. It had come down fast, and it was still falling. He got back on the horse and maneuvered it through the trees, but he had lost his bearings. He thought he had been following the slope down toward the river, but now he seemed to have fallen off into a ravine running the opposite direction. He tried to remember what he had brought with him. No tarp, no bedroll, only his most basic emergency supplies. Some matches, a pocket knife, a spare pair of wool socks. The lunch his mother had packed for him. Not much else. He saw the vague silhouette of a large spruce tree and headed toward it. He could wait out the storm here for a while. He broke off some of the tree's lowest branches and then used the edge of his boot to scrape snow away from the trunk. It was a shelter of some sort. He broke the branches over his knee into smaller pieces, then peeled some bark off a nearby birch. He had his axe. Once he got the fire going, he could chop larger pieces of wood. Sitting cross-legged beneath the tree, he piled the bark and spruce branches and lit a match, but it quickly sputtered out in the driving snow. Another. Another. Only a few left. Eventually, he got a small piece of the papery bark to light, but only for seconds before the wind snuffed it out. He stood and kicked at the pile. Snow from the branches above toppled onto his head. "Well, Jackson, guess we're pushing on." As he rode through the trees, he thought of stories he had heard of men killing their horses and climbing into their body cavities to stay warm. "Don't worry, Jackson. We're not that desperate yet." But this wasn't good. He could see that. He had slept out many nights, but never so ill-prepared in such bad conditions. Snow was embedded in the creases of his pants and coat. The horse's mane was coated in ice. He had no choice. He rode on, not knowing his direction. When he found himself on the banks of what appeared to be a frozen lake, a lake he had never seen or heard of before, he was afraid. He dismounted and stood beside the horse at the snowy shore. "God damn! God damn!" And he kicked the ground in front of him. The horse slowly blinked, too fatigued to move away from the commotion. "You're lost." Garrett jumped at the voice, an eerie whisper in his ear. Over his shoulder, he saw the girl like a ghost in the snow. Angry at being startled, he shouted, "What do you want?" "You have lost your way," she said, and again her voice was hushed and nearer than the girl herself. "No, I haven't." But they both knew he was lying.
"You won't find your way home," she said.
"No, I damn well won't. But I don't see you can do a thing about it." The girl turned and began to walk away.
"Follow me," she said.
"What?"
"I'll show you the way."
He wanted to yell, to kick his feet, to fight this absurd turn of events. But he took up the reins and led his horse after the girl. Without looking back,
She walked quickly and easily through the snow. At times he lost sight of her, but then she would reappear, waiting beside a birch or in a stand of spruce. "I didn't mean for this to happen," she said. "Even though I was angry, I didn't mean for you to lose your way."
"Well, of course not. How could this be your fault?"
The girl shrugged and walked again. The snow slowed, and patches of blue sky appeared overhead. When the mountains again revealed themselves, they were not where Garrett thought they would be. Where would he have ended up, he wondered, if she hadn't come for him? The girl's steps laced through naked birch trees, and a few times she lightheartedly looped an arm around one of their trunks as she passed by. She didn't seem to take note of where she was going or where she had been. She was like a fearless child playing in the woods, and yet she was tall and almost a woman. Her blue coat tapered in at the waist, her hair blonde and straight down her back. "You were there," she said, "when I killed the swan." She did not look back at him when she spoke, but ran ahead. Her feet lied on the snow, and for that, at least, Garrett was grateful. He didn't have to answer. He just had to follow and hope she never, ever spoke to him again. They traveled for some time in silence. "Your horse won't make it up here much longer," she said after a while. "The snow will be too deep." Garrett stopped walking and rubbed the back of his neck. Of all the blasted things she could say. "I know that," he said. "Don't you think I know that? I need a team of dogs, but my folks won't let me. Jackson's a good horse, though. I was going to use him a while, then snowshoe in. It would have worked." "If it weren't for you," he wanted to add. But he hated the whiny sound of his own voice, like a spoiled boy who hasn't gotten his way. Why couldn't he just keep quiet? That's what a man would do.
"There," the girl said, and pointed down through the trees. It was Jack and Mabel's place. He could see the fields white with snow and smoke curling up from their stovepipe.
He nodded and mounted his horse.